This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Kinda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Kinda.
Hello there. Welcome. I am Kinda Mason, and this is the Brown Rice Hour, the intersectional conversations of land, race, money, and spirit and culture. And so this is my first, the first recording of my new podcast with the Be Here Now Network. And I'm excited that my very first guest is my dear friend and amazing being, Ms. Fania Davis. So welcome, Fania.
Thank you for this honor.
It's so good. I can't believe that you said yes. Of course you did say yes. I'm so happy you said yes to doing this interview as my first guest on my podcast here. So I actually want to begin with stating where you're from and any land acknowledgement that you'd like to do.
Sure. I'm calling in from Oakland, California, the unceded territory of the Ohlone people. I actually was born and came of age in Birmingham, Alabama, the unceded land of the Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Alabama. So good to be here with you. And I just ask that I may, walk this land in ways that honor the ancestors of this land and ways that bring healing and wholeness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Fania. I, too, am on the unceded territory of the Ohlone in Oakland, California as well. And so I'm happy to be on this land with you and in this community with you and now on this podcast with you. So this is good. So I like to begin with, opening up sacred space, if that's good with you. And good. So in that opening of sacred space, what's important for me is to just take a moment. I actually have a candle here that I will light. And open up sacred space. We have a little candle here.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, I got a candle. And I have my Palo Santo, a bit of sage as well. Mm-hmm. And so opening up sacred space and taking a moment to go inside for a minute and really being present to our ancestors and really honoring the ancestors whose shoulders we stand on, who have gone through so much, and particularly our African ancestors to survive all that it took to get here, the passage, as well as the horrific chattel slavery. And here we are, and I'm grateful for them. I'm grateful for them. And I want to honor our ancestors, and I want to honor also the work that we are currently doing today that represents their wishes. And I also want to honor those who are coming, those generations who are still to come, that may we make them proud. Mm. That the work that we do today is the work that makes them proud of us, to say yes to us. So I would like to just thank them and thank all of the beings that help us do the work that we do. Ashe. Ashe. All right. So I want to welcome you to my first podcast, which is, like I said, I have these conversations, these intersectional conversations on land, race, money, and spirit. And it's just really important subjects for me, how they all intertwine in this country, particularly. I'm American-centric conversations around our history here on this land. And so land is really important, when just like we honored the land of the indigenous people who stewarded this land first. And then what has happened with land in this country, and how land is also the, it is what we consider wealth also in this country. It is based on land ownership. And you know, I like taking looks at those kinds of conversations and ownership of land in general. Who owns the land, really? Can we really own land? And then there's, of course, race has everything to do with this country, as well as racial capitalism and money. Mm-hmm. And money is at the seed of all of it, and underneath all of it is actually our dear spirits, the fact that we are spiritual beings, and the fact that we are all deeply interconnected. Mm-hmm. To the land, to the earth, to each other, to all species. Mm-hmm. And so at the core of everything really is spirit. And yet we forget, and yet we live our lives so absent of spirit. And so I want to presence, some conversations will be about different parts of that, those that intersectional conversation. And with you, we're going to see where we go. We definitely will be about, we'll see where we go. Yeah. And you actually, you have so much information and knowledge in all of those areas. And so I'm sure we'll touch on some of all of it. So I just want to thank you for coming. So let me introduce you to the people here who are watching or listening to this podcast. So Fania E. Davis, I'm going to read your bio, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I forgot to get my Palo Santo.
Oh, so okay.
Reading the bio.
You'll go get your Palo Santo.
So I can burn it as an offering.
Great. Very good. Very good. Okay. So she's going to get her Palo Santo, which is, again, this is what this is. And I am burning my Palo Santo. Palo Santo is sacred stick, is what it stands for in Spanish. And it is a cleansing, and it cleans the space, and really it's like what we think of, or what we use often as sage in this country. So a little bit about Fania Davis. Fania is a leading national voice on restorative justice, and she is a longtime social justice activist, a civil rights trial attorney, a writer, restorative justice practitioner, and educator with a PhD in indigenous knowledge. So coming of age, as she said, in Birmingham, Alabama, during the social ferment of the civil rights era, the murder of two close childhood friends in the 1963 Sunday school bombing, which hopefully all of you have heard about, it crystallized within Fania a passionate commitment to social transformation. For the next decades, she was active in the civil rights, Black liberation, women's, prisoners, peace, anti-racial violence, economic justice, and anti-apartheid movements. Studying with African indigenous healers crystallized Fania's search for a healing justice, ultimately leading her to serve as founder, director of Restorative Justice of Oakland Youth, RJOY, which is the acronym RJOY, and co-founding board member of the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice. Her numerous honors include the Ubuntu Award for Service to Humanity, the Dennis Maloney Award for Excellence in Youth Restorative Justice, the Black Feminist Shapeshifters and Waymakers Award, the Tikkun Repair the World Award, the Eller Baker Joe Baker Human Rights Award, the Bioneers Changemaker Award, the Lafarge Social Justice Award, and the Ebony Power 100 Award. The Los Angeles Times named Fania a new civil rights leader of the 21st century. Fania, who resides in Oakland, California, she writes and speaks internationally on restorative justice, racial justice, truth processes, and indigeneity. That's my friend, Fania Davis. Just amazing, amazing. What a history, what a life you've had and that you have crafted, and with all the many passions that you have, a PhD in indigenous knowledge. It's incredible. I want to ask you one first question that you don't know that I'm going to ask you. And it's a question that I like to ask. I'm going to ask my guests. And that is, what as a child, because this is the Brown Rice Hour, right? And I love food. I'm a foodie. And I like to ask about food. And I want to ask, as a child, what was your comfort food? And who prepared it?
Oh, I love that question. Before I answer it, I just want to show you. I didn't use my Palo Santo.
Okay.
Impepo.
Impepo.
It's used in the Zulu tradition in Africa to invite the ancestors.
Ah, beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your comfort food? Yeah. And who prepared it?
My comfort food. I love grits. And we would have grits every morning for breakfast. And my father made breakfast.
Huh.
Because my mother told him shortly after they were married and started having children, she called him by his last name. She said, Davis, you can either get the kids ready for school every morning or cook breakfast. Your choice. So he chose breakfast. And every morning we had these Southern style breakfasts, you know, grits and bacon, eggs and fried apples, and sometimes liver smothered in onions.
Oh my God.
On top of the grits.
Mm.
I love grits. My sister Angela hated grits.
She hates grits? She
hated grits.
No.
But I love them.
Oh God, and I love them.
I used to say, I love grits so much that I'm made out of grits. That was my
Okay, question. Were they sweet grits or not?
Oh no, they were just
good. Good.
Oh,
I know. I can't stand it when people put sugar on grits. I know. That's so crazy.
Sometimes I think my father would put cheese.
Cheesy grits.
Later. But yeah, now cheese is okay in grits.
Yeah, yeah. Grits was a big one. As a matter of fact, yesterday morning, my sister made me grits, cheesy grits. We use, of course, non-dairy cheese now because I'm vegan. And I was sitting here on a Zoom call, and she brought me a plate of grits. And it was just, oh, so good. I am so happy to hear that grits was it. And it was your dad.
My dad, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, he used the best breakfasts every morning.
Every morning.
Sit down at the table. I have three other siblings. There are four of us. So we would all sit down before going to work in school. My mother was a school teacher.
Okay. Yeah. And your dad, what did he do?
My dad was a teacher originally, but he ended up becoming an entrepreneur. He owned an auto parts store, a parking lot, and a gas station. Right in what's now known as the Civil Rights District, just a block away from the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham.
Oh, that's where you grew up. Bombingham, it was called then, wasn't it?
Bombingham, absolutely. Bombingham.
Yep. Birmingham. Mm-hmm. Well, can you just give us a little bit about Birmingham? Why was it called Birmingham?
It was called Birmingham because of the frequency of bombs that were exploded by racial terrorists, Ku Klux Klan, White Citizens Council, hate groups, white hate groups. Because this is what was the time of the rising civil rights movement, mm-hmm. that was challenging segregation, the system of segregation,
right,
head on. And so bombs were planted by these groups in an attempt to dissuade us, intimidate us, terrorize us, mm-hmm. frighten us into mm-hmm. action. Mm-hmm. Of course, it only made us more determined. Mm-hmm. And there were bombs in our neighborhood. We were very fortunate. But yeah. We were in a neighborhood that had just recently become desegregated, not really desegregated. We were just pushing the color line. The neighborhood mm-hmm. was still segregated, but just across the street, Center Street, mm-hmm. which is one of the streets that we lived mm-hmm. on, the white community began.
I see.
Behind us, all Black people. So we were one of the first families to move into that neighborhood called Dynamite Hill.
Dynamite Hill.
Called Dynamite Hill. And so they responded, yes, with the dynamite as more and more families started moving in. We were really blessed and there was some protection around us because our home was never bombed. We would wake up in the middle of the night to the sounds of bombs going off all around us.
Mm. And you grew up with that. That was, you were a child when all that was happening.
Right. And my father was part of a group of other fathers who were armed. They formed an armed patrol to protect their families. Mm. And that, I don't remember, but Angela can remember nights when she heard my father run downstairs and saw him grab his gun, go outside, because of noises that he heard. And then our church was firebombed because we had an interracial discussion group there. Our church is like a block, two blocks away from our home. And then across the street from the church lived a man called Attorney Arthur D. Shores, who was a giant. He was small in stature, but he single-handedly, as a litigator, brought down the system of segregation, whether in schools, education, wow. housing, employment.
Really?
And yeah, there are pictures of him and some of our history books walking with Thurgood Marshall, who of course became the first Black Supreme Court Justice.
Right.
When they were going to the Supreme Court to argue cases together back in the 50s.
And this is a white man.
Who?
This is who we're talking about. This is a Black man.
Oh, the lawyer.
The lawyer.
Who lived across the street from my church.
Yes.
Remember, it's a segregated neighborhood. So.
Okay.
He was Black.
He was Black.
Unsung Black hero.
Oh, I see. I don't know him.
The civil rights movement. Yeah. Very few. Okay. That's what I'm saying. And I hope that, you know, our history books tell us more about him, teach about him. Arthur D. Shores, his daughter, Barbara Shores, actually wrote a book about him called The Gentle Giant. But his home was bombed four times.
Whoa.
And he took to sitting out on his porch at night with his shotgun to protect his family. He was very fortunate. His wife was injured once, but not seriously. Actually, the fourth attempt to bomb the house was not successful. But three times they did, you know, destroy parts of the house.
Wow.
And then, of course, the bombing that everyone knows about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one.
Yeah.
September 15th, 1963.
Yeah.
At the 16th Street Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which took the lives of four girls. And blinded another girl. And two of those girls, Cynthia Wesley and Carol Robertson, were very close friends of mine. Cynthia lived just two doors away from me. We played together all the time. Carol lived farther away, but our families were close. We would go on vacations together. We were both family members of the Jack and Jill organization.
Oh, yeah.
So that bombing probably more than any other single experience of growing up in the apartheid-like city of Birmingham, Alabama. Mm-hmm. That experience is what kind of crystallized within me this irretrievable, irreversible, burning commitment and yearning to be an agent of social transformation. And that's what sort of put me on the path of this war, of being a warrior for justice.
And that you are.
My life has, comes out of that.
Yeah.
The seed of my beginning.
Yeah. Totally makes sense. I see that. And I see, I mean, just knowing your life and the passion and all the work you've done, and it's, I see how it would produce such beauty that you are and such a beautiful heart. I mean, I think about that also could have created a lot of hatred. It could have created someone with a lot of hate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, experiencing those kinds of experiences when hate comes at you like that. And so I just so appreciate who you are.
I went through my hate.
I'm sure you did. So, you know, this reminds me, I want to really jump to talking about your book. I love your book, and it's called The Little Book of Race and Restorative Justice, Black Lives, Healing, and U.S. Social Transformation. That book is, it's a little book, and I thought I had it up on me, but I was reading it in the other room, so I don't have it on me. I wanted to show it. It is, I love every page, every word on it, and where you take us with the idea of what justice could look like, you know. And so if there's, and you have this frame around the warrior and the healer, and I love that frame. And so I would love if you could talk a little bit about the book and that framing that you use.
Sure. The framing. I'll talk about the framing first, maybe.
Okay.
Coming out of those apartheid-like conditions, as I said earlier, in the South, and losing two of my closest friends to racial terror. And then, just a few years later, almost being killed by the police, myself and my husband. My husband was actually seriously wounded by police. This was at a time when we were working with the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. The police essentially invaded our apartment and pulled out guns. And my husband went to pull out his gun in self-defense. And they immediately shot at him. And the first bullet entered his shoulder and exited the side of his spine. Very, just millimeters away from the spine. And that's fortunate because he could have been paralyzed. Mm-hmm. I actually jumped on the back of the police officer who was holding, you don't think in those moments, right?
Right.
Who was training the gun on my husband about to kill him. I didn't know if he was killed already because one shot had already been fired. But just in a matter of seconds, I jumped on the back of the officer, and then I grabbed his gun arm and knocked it up. Wow. So the rest of the bullets went up the wall behind my husband and not into his body.
Wow.
And I just wanted to say that just to acknowledge that I, too, are among the millions who have been brutalized and almost killed by a police terror violence.
Yeah.
That
was in California, San Diego.
It was in San Diego. Yeah. So at this time of my life, and basically after leaving Birmingham and going away to college and then grad school, I was becoming more and more radicalized. I was actually learning how to shoot weapons. Mm-hmm. I was taking martial arts classes. Mm-hmm. We were considering going to Africa to get training in urban guerrilla warfare.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So for us, that was a time of war. And my anger was very much a part of my way of being in the world mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. And my anger at what happened in Birmingham was driving me. My anger at what happened to my husband and I, my anger at what happened to my sister, Angela Davis, who was nearly legally lynched based mm-hmm. on false, politically motivated capital murder, conspiracy, kidnapping charges. Yeah. So I came out of those experiences with, you know, as a warrior, you know,
yeah.
Just mm-hmm. as a downright dedicated and determined warrior. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went to law school. I became a trial lawyer. I started fighting racism in the courts. I'm still fighting racism in the streets, whether the movement against apartheid, the movement against exploitation of poor people and for economic justice. I was involved in many movements of the day, peace movements, women's movements, anti-imperialist movements, and so on. Mm-hmm. And after almost 30 years of cultivating the hyper-rationalist, hyper-masculinist, hyper-aggressive qualities that I needed to cultivate in order to be successful as a litigator and trial lawyer fighting race, and as an activist,
right.
I became sick. I became ill. Mm. And somehow I knew that I was being called, I was being invited to bring more healing energies, mm-hmm. more spiritual energies into my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The next phase.
And yes, so the next phase started at that point. Mm-hmm. And the universe sort of served these experiences up to me that I needed at that time.
Yeah.
I remember once coming out of the courtroom on Fallon Street, and you know, mm-hmm. listeners probably know, in Oakland, near the
lake. Oakland, yeah.
Just had a court appearance, and running down the steps to my next appointment, and then at the bottom of the stairway, this white woman with spiky red hair and just crystalline, sparkling blue eyes was blocking me. She was a prophetess, a homeless prophetess. She had her bin of her belongings mm-hmm. in front of her, mm-hmm. and she blocked my way, and I couldn't move. I didn't even try to move. It was as if I was frozen there.
Right.
And she looks at me and says, "Are you happy in your work? Are you happy with what you're doing?" I couldn't respond. I was just speechless. And she then turns around to face the lake and the northeastern sky. And she says, "You must learn from them. The bear beings," I believe she said. "You must learn from them." And then she starts to go away, you know, toward the west, and she turns around and says, "You must change." And she yelled "change" twice, louder and louder and louder.
Oracle.
Yeah.
Oracle.
Exactly. The homeless oracle.
The homeless oracle.
Yeah. And she was commanding me. She wasn't resisting. She was commanding me.
And you were ready for it. And you, it came. Yeah. The teacher shows up when the student's ready, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And what happened after that?
Oh,
did you change? Is that when things changed?
That's when things changed. Huh. At the same time, I was also having dreams. Just every night, I would have dreams of water. You know, of being in a deluge, being in a tsunami of somehow of breathing underwater as if I were a water creature. And somehow being born into another body under just water, you know.
Water. Yeah, Maya.
Mm-hmm. After I had the encounter with the homeless oracle, I studied the constellation that she was pointing to. And turns out that constellation contains ancestral knowledge and spirituality. That's the ark where ancestral wisdom is stored. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I was being called to become closer to my ancestors, you know, to engage in a spirituality that is an ancestral spirituality. At that time, I had been meditating and studying Hinduism and studying yoga and meditating at the ashram, the Siddha Yoga ashram.
Oh, the Siddha Yoga, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I saw what the oracle said as a call for me to recover ancestral spirituality.
Okay.
And I said, well, how am I going to do that? And then I started thinking about, well, maybe I'll go into a graduate program. And I looked at a few. And after I took trips to some of those places and talked to the people there, I said, oh, no, no, I cannot do this program because they are talking heads. They're not
embodied. Mm-hmm.
I need embodied knowledge. Yeah. I need embodied experiences. I need integrated body, mind, spirit, emotion. I need to learn and relearn in these ways and not perpetuate the same old fragmented and splitting
in
the world. That's what's getting me sick.
Right.
So I was a little discouraged, you know, about programs, graduate programs, until my yoga teacher said that he was doing a workshop on spirituality and science. And I said, oh, really? That sounds interesting. Where? He said it's CIIS, California Integral Studies.
Right.
And so I went there and found a program called Recovery of Indigenous Knowledge.
Beautiful.
And a PhD program that allowed me to learn from traditional elders and traditional healers from all over the world. Mm-hmm. Allowed me to actually spend 6 months all at once apprenticing with a South African, a great healer, Busama Zulu Preda Mutwa, who has now made his way to the ancestors just recently.
Okay. So all of this is the culmination of this warrior and healer, and that's the frame of the book.
Yes.
The warrior energy that you lived and the healer energy coming together.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. When I finished my apprenticeship as a healer myself with Busama Zulu Preda Mutwa and came home, I was very disappointed that I could not find any remunerative work that would pay me in the field of healing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I ended up kicking and screaming, going back into the practice of law.
Oh, you did? Okay. But different. It must have been different.
It was different.
It had to be different. You were different.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. My first client after my initiation, after coming back from Africa, was a Sudanese man who himself was initiated.
Mm-hmm.
Nuer. He had warrior marks on his face. He had warrior locks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sent to this country by his tribe to go to school. And when he finished, he vowed to use his knowledge and education for the benefit of his people.
Mm.
And he had been denied tenure by a local university, not because he was unqualified. Students loved him, got top-notch evaluations. His colleagues gave him incredibly high evaluations. He had more publications than the tenured professors did, yet he was denied tenure. So that was the case. That was my first case. So I got to...
That was your first case. Okay.
After coming back, you know.
From all right.
So I got to talk to the jury about this initiated man, and got to talk to the jury about how they had been chosen, because in his there are no accidents. That they had been chosen by
those 12 jurors. That those jurors, those 12 jurors, were chosen to be there. I love
it. To vindicate him.
I love it.
And to create.
I love it.
And
what an integration of the two worlds, of the legal world with this world. I love it.
Exactly.
So did what happened?
We had a great, we connected really deeply with this jury. Mm-hmm. And they gave us a verdict of about $700,000.
Wow.
And afterwards, we were talking to the jury members, and they were saying, Miss Davis, we thought you were going to start dancing and drumming.
And you almost did, didn't you?
Exactly. I said, well, you know, well, actually, he was talking about while we were litigating the case.
Right.
I was so deeply involved in conveying to them African spirituality, African indigenous culture.
Yeah, yeah.
That they said that. I said, well, yeah, actually... that is how justice is done in Africa traditionally, with drums. Yes,
with drums and dancing.
And with deep connection.
Yeah, yeah. And reminding people of who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. And so all of this then informs the restorative justice that you went have gone so deeply in. You are the voice of restorative justice in this country, honestly. And so a little bit about restorative justice and how it's different than what we call justice or penal justice.
Right. So even though I was very disappointed that I couldn't get a job, a paying job that would allow me to do healing work, I came back from Africa and I ended up kicking and screaming going back into the law profession.
Right.
It turned out to be a positive experience, not only because of the verdict and the way that the trial went for my client, but also because as a lawyer, I was invited by lawyers to a conference of lawyers. And that is where I learned about restorative justice.
Oh,
yeah.
Beautiful.
And, yeah, I learned about restorative justice from this district attorney from Austin, which is Travis County, Texas.
Okay.
And that was my first introduction to it. This man was amazing. He recently passed, but he had been able to be reelected a few times as district attorney because he was using restorative justice, which was reducing the crime rate and strengthening communities. So, yes, I heard about this justice that seeks to create community peace instead of deepening conflict. This justice that seeks to repair harm instead of replicate harm. This justice that seeks to repair relationships instead of deepening the conflict within those relationships. And this justice that heals instead of harms. It was a real epiphany for me. I kind of still remember the day, the room that we were in, and when I first heard about restorative justice. And it was an epiphany for me because I felt finally I can be both warrior and healer, because I was having difficulty around that time seeing that they were not irreconcilable opposites. You know, we in our culture, we are very binary. Something is one thing or another.
It's
good or bad, right or wrong.
That's right. That's right. Paradox is not good. Our minds don't hold both.
We don't hold opposites very well.
That's right.
We can't harmonize them in our mind.
Yeah.
Which, you know, reflects a sort of fragmented way of experiencing the world, of being in the world. But learning about restorative justice allowed me to be both. And I felt whole. I felt integrated. I could be both of these things at once. You know, I went through a period when I was in the movement, you know, like with Marxists and revolutionaries, even mm-hmm. though I was feeling this tug, this pull toward meditation, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. that spirituality, I hid it. I would do it, but I would do it undercover. I would be in the closet with it.
You didn't want your revolutionary brothers and sisters to think that you were weak or anything like that, right?
Metaphysical. She's not real. Then when I was around really spiritual people.
Right. It was, yeah, right.
Political. So,
right.
So in this moment, politics. When I heard about restorative justice, it allowed me both. To, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited that I just devoured every book I could find. I talked to all of the writers and the leaders in the restorative justice movement. I went to conferences, including a conference in Colombia, mm-hmm. in Cali, Colombia, mm-hmm. where Bishop Desmond Tutu was the
king. Oh, okay.
And the conference was about using restorative justice to bring peace to Colombia, which at the time was just wrecked and divided by gang warfare and all that. And not gang warfare, just massive drug conflict.
Now, is this post-apartheid or?
Yeah, this is post-apartheid.
Post-apartheid.
And so this was in the early, this was maybe, oh gosh, early 2000s maybe? Very early.
Oh, okay. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there were other people there from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Okay. Oh, good. Okay.
South Africa make its transition from apartheid to democracy. Well, you know, I don't say democracy. I'd say Western-style democracy. It made its transition from apartheid to Western-style democracy through the Truth and Reconciliation process, which mm-hmm. had a lot of flaws in many ways.
Yeah.
But one thing for sure it did. And that was, it allowed South Africa to make that transition post-apartheid without oceans of blood, without a civil war, because that was what was feared. And it
Absolutely.
Kind of enabled the spirit of healing, the spirit of Ubuntu, the spirit of forgiveness in the nation under Tutu.
Yeah, it wasn't perfect, but it was absolutely, I can't even imagine had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission not happened, what would have happened in that country. It's hard to imagine, yeah. So that's
well, really- I was really honored to meet people who were involved in that commission, and of course to meet Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
I was
doubly blessed because on the way back home from Cali, Colombia, I think we had to stop through Atlanta or Los Angeles, I can't remember. And we had a long delay. Mm-hmm. And somehow after getting off the plane, I ended up, you know, I saw Archbishop Desmond Tutu walking beside me
in the airport.
Four more hours before the plane to wherever it was. He happened to be going to the same place. And he says, come on with me. And he invited me into the lounge.
Yes.
For premium passengers. And we just had a nice chat for a couple of hours.
Oh, wow. What a blessing. That's amazing. What a beautiful being. What a beautiful being.
Yeah. Have you seen that picture of him and the Dalai Lama?
Oh, God, yes.
The book together?
Yes. I have the book. Have you seen the book that they did together?
I haven't seen the book.
Yes, I have it. I should. It's in my bookcase. It's incredible. It's really wonderful. Talking about joy is in the title. I can't remember the name of it, but yeah. It's just amazing. So then from all of that, restorative justice just became a part of you, and you became a part of it. It was just like fish to water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was very inspired by the possibilities of justice and healing.
Yeah.
Through restorative justice processes.
Well, you know, what you've done here in Oakland, I have to say, with Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and Our Joy, it's just been just unprecedented, phenomenal, what is happening here in Oakland and how it's being used in our public schools. It's an incredible success. Because that is who we are. I mean, this penal way of dealing with harm is absolutely ridiculous. It's like, let me harm you for the harm that you've done. And harm upon harm upon harm does not bring peace, does not bring anything but more harm and more hate. And so what you have been bringing with restorative justice in Oakland has just been really, really tremendous, Vanya. Thank you for all that you've been doing. You know, I'm also really curious, just kind of jumping to where we are right now. Mm-hmm. And this is what day? Well, actually, this is like the second and a half week, two and a half weeks since George Floyd was murdered.
Won't tomorrow be?
Tomorrow will be 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah.
It'll be 3 weeks tomorrow.
Monday, 25th.
Right. It'll be 3 weeks tomorrow since George Floyd was murdered, and our country and the world has fundamentally changed in a lot of ways. A lot has happened. And I'm curious, given your history of the movement before in the 60s and the movement now that you're seeing, if you can talk about the difference between those movements and what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, Kanda, I cannot believe, you know, what we're seeing today. And it's the changes, the possibilities, the things that are happening now, I just wouldn't have imagined, you know.
Yeah.
And the possibility for transformation is so present in this
moment. I know, right? It's palpable.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's really, really excited.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's, you know, the sadness that comes with it. Yeah. And then another brother just getting murdered last night in Atlanta.
And, you know, as everyone's saying, you know, enough is enough. And as Felonise Floyd said at the congressional hearing, stop this. Yeah. And so what's amazing and what's different today is that people have just overnight graduated from systemic racism 101. You know,
I mean, you never heard that word in the public discourse. I mean, Black people, we've been talking about it forever.
Yes.
But to hear people in Washington, white men in suits, talk about systemic racism.
And to hear Mitt Romney saying Black Lives Matter and marching, you know, the
Republican. And marching in the street?
It's just so amazing. Because most people, and not just white people, a lot of white people for sure, thought of racism as something that someone said or did to or other Black people.
Can you square that up right now a little bit? Let's just act like we're talking to people who don't know the difference and just a little bit of definition here around racism, if you don't mind, and structural racism and what people think is racism.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a complicated story because it goes all the way back to our beginnings, the seeds of who we are, the seeds of our beginning. In white supremacy, in slavery, in land theft, in genocide. That's where it all began. This radical commitment to white supremacy.
Okay, so now I'm going to stop you there because white supremacy, most white people think that white supremacy are the Ku Klux Klan, people who wear the white and the real radical, absolutely neo-Nazi types, that's what white supremacy is and that's not them. So therefore, they're not a part of it.
But that is what is changing too, Kanda.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah. White supremacy used to be a sort of marginalized, you're a bit kooky or, you know, on the edges if you talk about white supremacy. But now you find it, you know, in newspapers, in daily newspapers, not just, you know, in corporate media, not just in progressive media. You see it in books, in academia. You hear it on the news. It wasn't even like this just a couple of years ago.
Right.
You see it in the discussions around the countless removals of the Confederate statues that are coming down.
Right. Right.
How many cities? Well, about 120 or 20, 125 of those statues have come down in many cities across the
nation. Yep.
So people, and it's a question of just of truth telling and, mm-hmm. and acknowledging the massive pain that our country, that our government has inflicted since the very beginning in the name of white superiority. You know?
Yeah.
So people are starting to see that it's not just individuals who are not nice to other individuals who happen to be Black.
Yeah.
Because they've seen those videos over and over and over and over again.
And it's not just a bad apple. It's not a bad, one bad apple. I mean, one of the things that is really, I hope, becoming clear is that this country was actually built on the ideology of white supremacy, meaning that, you know, the superiority of white people. And that is in every institution, that is in everything that we come in contact with. And so it's not like it's those people who are extremists with, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. Those, yeah, they are white supremacists, but definitely. That it is a literally an ideology that this country is built on.
And
lives by. And so we can't
It's a founding principle.
It's a founding principle of America.
That we are committed to.
That's right. To uphold. That's right.
And to disrupt that commitment right
now. That's right. That's right.
Yes, it's not just a bad apple.
No, it is a fabric.
If it were just a bad apple or two, we could indict them. We could
convict
them. They would be sentenced and serve their time.
Right.
And presumably, you know, the police department would be okay again.
Right.
That's not it. It's the whole barrel that is rotten.
Yeah.
Like every other institution, social agency, structure in this country, it is drenched and saturated and permeated in white supremacy.
That's
why it's just so heartening to see people talk about, you know, systemic racism now and understanding that it's not enough to get rid of the individual, you know.
Yeah. No, it's not.
A new system, because Black lives will never matter under the current system policing in this country.
Yeah.
But, you know, the really kind of interesting thing is that logic applies to every single institution in this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Every single, whether it's
housing,
education, health, they're all drenched and saturated and permeated in white supremacy.
Yeah.
So what so excites me is that I think we're poised to have a massive breakthrough in this country when it comes to finally naming and taking responsibility for and transforming systems.
Yeah. Because people have to be able to see it and understand it and understand that it is systemic. And one after the other, these incidences with the police is showing that this is, and then when you really open your eyes, you can't help but see the disparities of Black folks in America and how we live and what is available in our neighborhoods and what's not available and the green spaces that, you know, in the good neighborhoods and the good schools and all of those kinds of things.
Right. And the people. Right. Who are infected with coronavirus are dying at 3 times the rate of white people, you know?
Well, so now we're talking about the double pandemic, right? We have right now in America, we have a double pandemic, the pandemic of the coronavirus and the pandemic of racism, both coming together in such a way that the light is so brightly shining on it that it actually, the silver lining is that people are beginning to see that this is not a coincidence, that Black people are dying in the streets and they're dying in the hospitals and they're dying everywhere based on a system that has created a lifestyle that has been unhealthy, intentionally so, lack of resources and safety.
Absolutely. It's as if, you know, all of the ugliness of who we are as America, that has 401 years been buried, you know, but is festering, infected. Coronavirus glances it. George Floyd glances it. And all of it coming out. All those toxins, you know.
That's exactly what's happening. And it's an incredible time in history right now, in U.S. history. I want to jump to, because we're going to have to start going towards wrapping soon, but I really want to jump to all that's happening in the streets, that young people keep staying out there as long as you can. I love that they're out there, that this is happening. And what is missing in terms of, we're hearing about systemic racism, we're hearing about white supremacy, we're hearing about all these concepts that we just mentioned that people need to know about. What about the healing?
Yeah. Yeah, we're not hearing about that.
We're not.
As much, you know what? I've got to go and get my plug because my computer is dying.
Your computer's dying. Okay, go. I'm sure we'll get with that. No worries. No worries. So I suppose we will make an edit here.
Okay. Sorry about that. I thought I had it. I had like 70.
No worries.
No worries.
All good. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you did that. So tell me, about the healing that seems to be.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, about the healing, we haven't heard so much about that. We've seen have you seen those articles from artists, like from the actors and producers and writers and film and in theater that came out a few days ago called Dear White People? Is it Dear White People? Something like that.
I haven't seen it.
Dear White American Theater.
That's oh, no. It. Oh, gosh.
Mm-mm. And it is a letter that does truth-telling.
Okay.
Many of us know about what systemic racism looks like in our universities, what it looks like in our schools with the school-to-prison pipeline, racial disparities, and discipline. We know what it looks like in corporate America with the glass ceiling for Black people and with racial harassment, you know. We've seen the inner workings of systemic racism in so many settings, mm-hmm. But not in theater. We haven't, there's not been a public expose.
Interesting.
Racism. And right. I didn't even realize it until I read this letter signed by 500, you'll know most of the artist's names, mostly Black, the leading actors, writers, and producers of Black film and Black theater. And it just one by one lists all the ways in which white American theater dismisses Black humanity. In some cases even pathologizes Black, stereotypes of Black actors and artists. Just in very specific ways.
Okay.
They must recount about 20 ways in which white American theater has been doing this.
Right.
For decades. 500 people signed it. The next morning after it was dropped on social media, 50,000 had signed it.
Wow.
And now we're seeing statements from theaters in California, from theaters in Northern California, that are very similar. It's kind of a Me Too moment. A lot of anger is coming out.
Okay.
We're seeing that. And that has to, before the wound can heal, it's got to be glanced.
That's right.
Fester. And so, I mean, that's part of the healing. It can be part of the healing process.
Yeah.
But I think the first mention I've seen of healing in any major media outlet is the statement that came out by the Minnesota City Council, who talks about how, they're going to, when they're asked, how are you going to defund the police? Because the city council has decided it is going to defund the police. And then when asked by the media, how are you going to do that? And they said, we don't know.
Right.
But the community knows. The people who are most directly impacted by this, they know. And we are going to create a space where they can envision a new future of public safety where Black lives matter. We're going to go to them. And one city council member said a few days ago that they were going to use a truth and reconciliation process to elicit that wisdom from the ground, from the community.
From the ground up, yeah.
And then they issued this city council resolution just very recently, maybe Friday. And it talks about this process, this truth process that they want to begin. And she mentions, they mention healing. They said it will center healing and reconciliation.
Good.
That's a statement. And then it says further down in the resolution that they will invite healers and elders and activists to be part of this envisioning process, this process of calling forth a new future. So I was very heartened by that.
That is really beautiful to hear. Because, you know, ultimately, Vanya, we have this planet together. Right? We live on this planet that is ailing so much, that is, you know, that is human made, as we know, the problems that we have. And ultimately, our liberation is tied together. It's not like, you know, we're on this sinking boat and I'm going to be saved and you're not. I mean, we are in it together. And so our liberation is tied, all of us. And we're deeply interconnected. I mean, I think that if people didn't understand how deeply interconnected we are into the coronavirus, when, you know, someone in Wuhan coughs and it fills up the hospitals in San Francisco, right? We are absolutely deeply interconnected on this planet Earth with each other, with all species, with the planet. And we have got to find a way of peace, a way of honoring all lives. And it begins right now in America with All Lives Matter. That is the meme. And it's so important for people to understand that. This is so important because Black lives have not mattered. They have not mattered. They're not valued. Our bodies are not valued like white bodies are. And so finding a place of healing with us and peace is going to take a long time. It's a lifetime journey. And I think that a lot of people listening to this podcast are people who I hope are interested in healing, are interested in learning, are interested in growing, changing, transforming the racism within them, whether they admit it or not. That is the air we breathe. So it's there within you. And what does it take to transform that? And how do we, as Black people and brown people and white people and Asian American people and Indigenous people, live harmoniously on this planet and in this country? Is it possible? Is it possible? Do you think it's possible?
I do. It's a long road ahead, you know.
It's a long road.
It's a long road. And, you know, what's going on now in Minnesota with this process of envisioning the future?
Yeah.
A future way of ensuring public safety where Black lives matter. Because we know Black lives matter. All lives matter. I mean, like you said once when we talked about reparations. Yeah. Our reparations is what we need to do. Now, how did you put it? Reparations means doing stuff that shows that we love Black people.
I talk about we want to create an infrastructure and economy that loves Black and brown people. That's what we want. And a society and an economy that loves Black and brown people.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. Because If it loves black and brown people,
then it loves everybody.
Everybody.
Then it loves everybody.
Love the earth.
That's right. Then it loves the earth. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's what we are working towards.
And yeah, we're working toward that. And you know, one thing, and I guess this is why I'm so attracted to restorative justice. Mm-hmm. In order to get to that end product of a world whose economic, education, health, housing system, love black people.
Yeah.
In order to get to that end point where all of those systems make black lives matter.
Yeah.
In order to get to that end point where everyone's needs are met and we acknowledge the bonds of our inherent relatedness. We are seen, we are heard, we feel a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, we thrive. To get to those place, to get to that endpoint, we must do so in a way that reflects the values of that end product.
Yes.
Let me see if I can put it this way. We can't get to a new place in an old way.
In an old systems way. Live, that's right.
Yes. Systems right. live in us. So right. that healing that we were talking about earlier has to happen.
Yeah.
If we are truly going to bring forth institutions where Black lives matter, systems.
That's right.
We have to transform ourselves as we transform the world.
That's right.
Because there's no difference, really.
No, that and inside, the inside outside.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm hoping that the process in Minnesota will not only be focused on coming up with a vision for a new of assuring public safety.
Right.
But I'm hoping that that vision is engendered through a process where people are transforming themselves to reflect the values of that of the future.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that is absolutely necessary and possible. I want it to be, I want a world where when you had to be in the closet with your meditation and your yoga and your spiritual practice and be a warrior and outwardly, may that not, that dichotomy never have to happen again. May that come together so that this generation and being Black woman led, this Black, this movement for Black lives has been Black woman led, which has hope for me that it will actually come to that healing place and bring together all that we are internally with the external, and that white people, Black people, brown people, that we will all be able to see that we have to develop a heart mind. We have to develop and rid ourselves of all the junk that has been, that we were born into and that we have watered and cultivated. All the isms that we can excavate that. And it's going to take time and it's going to take honesty. It's going to take honesty. It's going to take courage. Mm. It's going to take the courage to say, this is what I am doing and I'm showing up and I'm not perfect and I'm going to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take on our side, on all sides, saying forgiveness about mistakes and knowing that we are in this together because we're all going to make mistakes. Because I mean, I see mistakes being made with, you know, right now. And I'm like, bring the love, y'all. Bring the love. As long as we bring the love into this process, which is inherent, it's underneath it. The reason why they're out in the streets, because they love something so much, right? They love life so much. They love dignity so much. They love justice so much. And so bringing that love forward is what I think is going to be the answer. And when love is forward, it is a force. It is a force. And it will, so I'm just trusting that that's what's going to happen here.
And we got a lot of work to do to get us.
Oh my God, we've got so much work to do.
Where the love can free.
We've got a lot to do, but we got to do it one by one and two by two and individuals and who to, and mentorship. Mentorship is so important.
Absolutely.
You know, who are you talking to? What young people are you mentoring? What young people am I mentoring?
Right, right.
That is the key. You know, we're going to unfortunately have to wrap this conversation. I'm just feel like we're just getting started. This has been so wonderful, Fania. So wonderful.
And so grateful to you.
Yeah. So I am.
Yeah.
Say that again.
I said we will continue. I feel
yes. Oh gosh. Yeah. We'll continue. Maybe we'll do a part two. Maybe we'll do a part two on the Brown Rice Hour, but you and I will continue, obviously. So I just want to really thank you for being here, being the first guest, being the guinea pig, so to speak, and see how this works, this podcast. I hope folks are, you know, finding it interesting. I can't imagine that they won't. And I want to close out with a metta for Black Lives, if that's okay with you. So I would like to close with metta, and which is a loving kindness moment. And this one is specifically for Black lives right now. And so may all Black lives be safe and protected and resourced abundantly with housing and healthy food to eat and clean water to drink and the health care that is needed. Mm-hmm. And may every Black mother's child be valued equally as every white mother's child, mm-hmm. and provided with the same love and care and resources to live their lives fully. Mm-hmm. And may the delusion of white supremacy be laid to rest. Mm-hmm. And may all beings live in the understanding that we are deeply interconnected to each other and to the earth and to all species. And may all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And may Black lives matter. Ashe.
Ashe. Well, powerful. My favorite metta thus far. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Fania, for joining me. This is, again, Conda Mason with the Brown Rice Hour. And I'm happy to be on this podcast now, having conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, spirit, and culture. And we hope to see you again. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.